this evening we're very lucky to have with us Sheila Coleman, old friend of Bristol Radical History Group from the Hillsborough Justice Campaign, who is going to bring us up to date with the debate over Hillsborough. And as many of you will know, a lot of documents surrounding the Hillsborough disaster, cabinet papers in particular, but also police papers, should be coming into the public domain finally. And there is remains considerable dispute about who's going to get the papers, who's going to get to them first, and whose interpretation is going to be put on them. I just wanted to say, on a sort of personal level, I know a little bit about this kind of experience. My old man was murdered over 10 years ago, and dealing with, you know, the aftershock of a violent and sudden death. There are many ways to the mountaintop, but for me anyway, putting the story straight, seeing the paperwork, and taking command for myself of what happened and how it happened was one of the most important sort of healing processes. And, you know, I didn't have to deal with a kind of, you know, the British state to get hold of that. And the thought of actually having to fight your way through the kind of armature of the British state and its secrecy to get that story, you know, it's an extraordinary testament to people's energy and patience and perseverance not to go completely bonkers in the face of that. And the other thing I just again wanted to say on a personal level is that, thinking about this over the last couple of days, I've been transported back to the 1980s, and it's a reminder that, you know, Hillsborough, while first and foremost a personal tragedy for so many people, is also now part, a really profound part, of the popular consciousness of the history of the last 30 or 40 years and what has happened to Britain. And one of those crucial moments where, in a way, the coalition that made Thatcherism possible bared its teeth and showed what it was really all about. And one of the extraordinary things, I think, that is going to come out of this struggle to get these papers is to see what was happening at the very highest level in cabinet papers and cabinet minutes. And of course, most of the juiciest stuff will be edited out, but I haven't forgotten what class warrior that woman was, despite the depiction in The Iron Lady from Meryl Streep. And that's a memory and a history worth raking over. So to help us rake over that history, to heal some of those wounds and to make sense of some of this, let's welcome Sheila Coleman. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for inviting me, and it looks like a great venue, a great location, and I'm pleased to be able to come back and speak with you. I know that I recognise some faces from last time, and so I'm not going to go into the history of the Hillsborough disaster or anything, because I think it is well documented, and I'm sure that people here you know the background to it. When I was here a few years ago, there had just been a discussion about bringing about papers being made public, and at that time, I think, if my memory serves me right, the justice campaign that I belonged to was fighting to be involved in the process whereby there was going to be some sort of inquiry or something was going to come out. And following on from that, we were left out of all proceedings. It was the families in the justice campaign are families who were expelled from the family support group because they were quite proactive and didn't want to just basically accept what was thrown at them. So you had this bizarre situation of bereaved families being expelled from a family support group. And our campaign is made up of bereaved families, survivors, and people like me who support the issues around Hillsborough. And Alan Johnson was Home Secretary at the time, and it was published that members of the family support group, committee members, had met with Alan Johnson, but they wouldn't tell us what the meeting was about because they said they'd signed a confidentiality agreement. In fact, they wouldn't even tell their own members what it was about. And to this day, we don't know what was agreed between the then Home Secretary and three people from the family support group. I have my suspicions, but couldn't prove anything. So then it was announced that the government was going to set up a panel a Hillsborough independent panel to review all documents. And we were still being left out of the equation on this, so we began campaigning to try and be included. And we were ignored. And literally it took writing and emailing. I personally bombarded Alan Johnson almost on a daily basis with emails, just sending another email, including the one I'd sent before, etc. And other people, and you know, it really is time consuming, and a couple of families were doing the same. And in the end, someone must have been smart enough to think, well, they're not going away. And so they offered to meet with us, not Alan Johnson, but members of the Home Office. And so we met with what is now known as the Secretariat, which is made up of members of the Home Office, the Hillsborough Independent Panel Secretariat. And we were saying we wanted to meet with Alan Johnson. And basically they said, oh, you'll be included. And we were going, well, we want to know, before we start off, we want to know what the agreement was, because we can't come into this without knowing what's going on. We want to know what was agreed, so we can then decide whether we want to be involved or not. That was never forthcoming, so we've always been trying to play catch up. On the day that the panel was formally announced and there was an official meeting of the panel members and families, they didn't meet with all Hillsborough families. What they did was give groups appointed times and met them separately. And so we met with them, by which time we had been given the remit of the panel. And we had looked through it and had seen things within it that we were concerned about. We felt there were limitations, and it was around confidentiality agreements and around disclosure. So when we went to meet with the panel, it was very nice, they wanted it to be nice tea and sympathy kind of setup, and we asked how much of an allotted time we had, and they seemed very frustrated that we wanted to get down to business and we didn't want the sandwiches. We just wanted to know, like, you know, this remit, you know, we're unhappy about this, we're unhappy about this. And we had also asked for representation on the panel, because the family support group had pushed for two people to be on the panel as their representatives, and that wasn't forthcoming either. So at the two crucial questions I think we asked was, at this thing, I spoke on behalf of the families and just basically went through the remit, pointing out our concerns. And at the end of it, the response was from the Bishop of Liverpool, who chairs the panel, oh, you asked very profound questions, we couldn't possibly answer them now, could you put them in writing? I subsequently put in what had been said in writing, and, you know, basically 1, 2, 3, wanting answers 1, 2, 3. And what we got back was just a generic letter that didn't even bear any resemblance to the questions that were asked. Two of the questions asked were around that people on the panel would not benefit either personally or professionally from any information that they would have access to, that they would have access to, that other people wouldn't have access to. And I aimed those at two people on the panel, and they were the two people who'd been requested by the family support group. And no assurances were given, and I know now that what I suspected was going to happen is going to happen. And I'll come back to that a bit later on. The second thing was around the panel having access to information that families couldn't have access to. And it was stated very clearly within the remit that there would be some information which the panel might have to request. And if access was given to the panel, they would have to sign a confidentiality agreement saying they wouldn't pass that information on. So I asked the panel, were they prepared to do that? And if they weren't prepared to do it, then how could they be on the panel and go along with it? And again, certain people on the panel kind of reacted to that in particular ways. We felt they were very pertinent questions that went to the heart of it, because why should strangers effectively have access to information along the lines David spoke about in respect of his father. And it's crucial to us. You want the evidence, and for any of you that you know that have been bereaved, and you know I've been bereaved in circumstances where I've wanted to know the facts and where it's been important to make sense of someone's death, and it wasn't okay for me until I saw that coroner's report, until I saw the police statements, because then you make sense of it. And that is all basically we were saying. And it just seemed wrong to us that the information was going to be, people would have access to it who had had no involvement in some cases, and that families possibly would never have access to that information because it was deemed confidential. So this was the framework in which we had to decide, did we want to work in it or not? So we went, we'll go along with it, you know. So we did things like, well, we want to meet with you. Well, meet on our terms, meet in our premises. We have a shop opposite the ground where we have a meeting room, and sort of similar setup to this really, where, you know, it's dual role. And so we did things like that. The panel very quickly broke up into a subgroups, and the family subgroup came to meet us in the shop. At this stage, and it was something else we raised at the initial meeting, there was nothing in the remit at all referring to survivors, or that they would look into the role of survivors or the treatment of survivors. And we've long argued that the survivors are a neglected group of people who played a crucial role on the day in terms of acting as rescuers, but also evidentially as well, because they were first hand, they saw what went on. And we did get the panel to shift on this when they came to the shop, and we had survivors there who spoke very eloquently, and they did seem to backtrack a bit on that. But it has to be said that the panel gave out that they would meet with families on a regular basis and update them on what was happening. I can tell you to date, no one's any wiser. In the few meetings we had with them, it just seemed to me that they were picking the brains of the people who knew. They wanted the information from those who knew. Nothing wrong with that, but it should be a two-way process. And whenever questions were asked, it was like, oh, it's progressing nicely, and it'll be in the report. So that is incredibly frustrating for people who are taking a leap of faith to engage in a procedure that they feel they're running from behind in anyway, because they don't know the parameters and they don't know what was set up in terms of an agreement beforehand. So this all went on, and you have to put my glasses on now to see that. Because we kicked off at the beginning, and this is relevant obviously to someone here, because we kicked off and said, you know, this is unfair, there are two people on this panel clearly representing the family support group and we don't have any similar representation, they were saying, oh no, they're not representing them, but I can show you in written stuff how they are. So then when the panel was announced, almost right away, and I think it was as a result of us kicking off, to be honest, that there was a gap. They rang me and said they'd realised it was a great oversight. There wasn't a lawyer on the panel. It hadn't obviously entered their head till that point. So you can, you know, draw your own conclusions from that. And they said, would we like to recommend anyone, or could we recommend anyone? So I said, well, we could recommend several people, but we wouldn't without speaking to them. And in any event, I spoke to Daniel Bennett here, and Daniel said he would agree to speak with them. And Daniel, you might want to come in on this after to speak of your own experience on it. Daniel Daniel agreed to meet with them, and in any event, Daniel was rejected in favour of someone else. I have been told that the Home Office people wanted Daniel. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, Daniel, to be honest with you. I don't believe very many people in all this now. And it was actually Alan Johnson who didn't.
Yeah, they told me that, but I don't believe that either.
I don't believe that at all. And you know, increasingly, I don't believe things they're told. So therefore, when they asked us, I thought, oh, great, we're making some progress here. They've seen it's an oversight. They want it more inclusive. They want someone we've recommended. It was never going to come off, you know. And this is, you know, no criticism of the person they did appoint. But I went to a lot of time. Daniel went to a hell of a lot of effort in terms of meeting with them, and then, and Daniel best to explain this himself, but kind of the pathetic excuses they made and the kind of being, I think you, so you've experienced a bit of the nicey nice stuff I'm talking about, of how they try to, it's incredibly patronising how they treat you. So we carried on with this. What we said right at the beginning was, and it was tactical on our part, rather than the panel meet, or the sub-panel group, have to meet with three different groups for reasons of expediency. Why don't they just meet all the Hillsborough families together? If it's an information dissemination, then, you know, what's wrong with meeting the groups together? Anne Williams, who is sort of on her own, in her own group, who lost her son, she was amenable to that. Obviously, we were. And we don't know whether they ever asked the family support group or whether they asked them and the family support group said no, but no meeting of all groups together has ever occurred, which, you know, is not really cost effective and just, again, breeds suspicion that one group is being told one thing, another group is being told another. And I'll get back to that in a minute, because something did happen in respect of that. So really not much happened with it all. Until in July of this year, it was announced that the commissioner, the information commissioner, had agreed that a request under Freedom of Information for the minutes of the cabinet meeting held a few days after Hillsborough under Margaret Thatcher, the commissioner ruled that it was in the public interest. This followed on from a request from Martin Rosenbaum for the BBC. So we were pleased with that, because we thought, okay, this is outside of this, but again, it's going to be something, it will, and you know, like David, you know, I have no illusions around stuff that isn't minuted, and also how, you know, you've had 22 years to control information and to lose information. I mean, if they lost, you know, the CCTV cameras from the control room on the day, which was essentially a crime scene, on the what have they done after 22 years, you know. Nevertheless, we were quite pleased with that. I got asked to do a radio interview, and I, on my way there, I tried to get the Home Office so I could say on air what their take on it was. I couldn't get them, so I left a message, and afterwards, when I returned the call, I spoke to the Home Office woman who liaises mainly, and she made it clear to me that the panel would not be happy with information coming out under Freedom of Information. And she was very, very clear, the panel would not like it. And I asked why, and a patronising analogy to me was, it's like a complicated jigsaw, Sheila, and this is just one piece, and the one piece isn't much good. You need it all together, and we're going to give you it, the panel's going to give you it in context, so forget about that piece. And I said, well, that doesn't hold water, and we would be very disappointed should anyone choose to appeal. And I suppose naively I was thinking that the panel would appeal. There was a month to appeal, I think, and it was left to the 11th hour, and the government appealed. And this is where games are being played, because the government appealed, saying that they would appeal it because the information should be in context. And they used the exact terminology that had been used to me and the exact reasons as had been given to me. And so I heard this on the radio. I was at home and I heard it on the radio. Well, so I looked online and it was just breaking as news. And I was so angry that I banged out a statement on the internet and put it round for people to put out, saying, you know, how we were opposed to the appeal and whatever, and we didn't trust the panel anymore. And then the e-petition started on the back of that. And it's a great example of how, when the media is against you, you utilise technology, because from us basically voicing our concern over what the government had done in appealing, we kicked off this e-petition. One of our supporters kicked off this e-petition, which gathered such momentum, you know, and basically we threw government policy back at them. They'd said, they prevented us with the Freedom of Information thing, and then this e-petition, which was obviously this, you know, a sham of democracy. Hey, you can have your say, just get 100,000 signatures, you know, and assuming no one's going to get 100,000 signatures. And we managed to get over 100,000 signatures in less than a week, which is tremendous. And also says a lot about other stuff, because really some really good petitions are not getting signatures. The NHS one, for example. And it saddens me really when people can do it on this issue and they can't extend it beyond. Even if all the people who just signed that petition signed the one about the NHS to get some debate. Nevertheless, we did do that. And what it, and within it all, when we started the petition, and I don't want this to sound like sectarian, us and them, the justice campaign against the family support group, but it has to be said in this context, because that's the only way you'll understand it. That, and really, that's you have to appreciate that the family support group, or the, not generally, but the committee, the hierarchy of that group, are basically work hand in hand with the system. And it's sad, but there will always be people who will be bought off, and you have to say it like it is. And to be honest, I'm getting like a little bit sick of pussyfooting around, not saying things, and not wishing to offend, because whilst you're doing that, other people are just taking total advantage. When we first started the e-petition and it was gathering momentum, the chair of the family support group came out opposing it, right, and saying they shouldn't be meddling, it should, we want the information out through the panel, we don't want it under freedom of information, and we don't want this. And obviously media, it gets so big they can't ignore it. So the Echo, the Liverpool Echo, then come out stating something, but they go to the family support group for the quote. Liverpool Football Club on LFC TV, the net thing, they go to the family support group. So you had the bizarre thing, we were doing the petition, but no one had even mentioned us. So we were like getting all these signatures, we were just doing all this stuff, and you know, getting people on our side tweeting. I mean, you know, the hero of the hour for us was actually Joey Barton, who, you know, Joey Barton, I know he's quite infamous for his infamous full stop, but infamous for his tweets. And when he got behind us, it just like took on this momentum. It was absolutely amazing. And he came and sat in the House of Commons with us as well, actually. But so you had the bizarre thing of when it gathered such momentum, the family support group had to forget their earlier statements of saying we don't agree with this, to then issuing a statement saying it's wonderful the support we have, and making it very, very general. It's great when you see it. So they issued a statement which went on the front page of LFC TV. So we contacted them and said, look, we don't want you to accept us. We don't want you to think we're wonderful and fight our corner. Just give us equal access. Put our statement, our original statement, which then sparked this e-petition, put that up. Oh, couldn't do that. Well, why couldn't you do it? Well, you're very critical of the panel. And I said, well, that's what started this statement. Oh, no, we work very closely with the family support group and the Hillsborough panel, and no. And but would like to speak to you. This is one of the top guys. That's another story, because it's very frustrating, the time I've given people sort of privately, the director of Liverpool, he said, look, will you explain all this to me, the differences? And I sat down with him. This was when he was the commercial director, and he went, I'll sort this. And I went, good luck to you, because you won't. And he was like, so he'd sort it. Now he avoids my emails and stuff. And he passed me on to this other guy who was the press officer. And he said, well, no, we won't. And I said, well, it's very to the point. It's very direct, and yet what's very true. And it's, you know, please... No, so I saw I was getting nowhere with him. He said, but look, I would like to sit down with you and have a coffee to see how we can work closer together. So I said, well, I'm telling you how we can work closer together. You print this, and that's the start. Well, no, so I ended the conversation saying, this is a waste of time. You know, I've taken enough of my time. You've taken enough. You're not going to budge, and I've got better things to do. But can we meet for a coffee so we can discuss how we can help you? Well, no, it's a waste of time. I'm giving you a clear... I'm just saying, give the supporters the honest truth. You're giving them a skewed version, and they deserve better than that. So we got no support on that one. Anyway, as this petition is taking, gathering momentum, we hit the 100,000. It ended up being 100, just under 140,000, I think. And so that only means that it can be discussed, that it might be debated. It doesn't mean it's got to be debated. It goes to the back benches. But obviously the momentum had gathered so much in terms of publicity that it was a goer. One of the Merseyside MPs, who himself was at Hillsborough, had taken it up, and that's another story, because it's in a watered-down version, and egos were running rampant as the date for the debate got near, as you might imagine. A date was agreed to have the debate in the House of Commons on the 17th of October, which was actually my birthday, so it was a weird one. Before the debate, I pushed to meet with Steve Rotherham, the MP for Walton, who was leading on this, and he showed me the motion that was going, and it was such a watered down version of the e-petition, which is frustrating. And he didn't even mention it was that the information go to the panel first. It didn't even mention families until I pointed that out to him. And I said, but we're saying we want the government to drop the appeal, and we want it to go to, we want it's under freedom of information, at least the cabinet minutes. And I also said that we wanted a meeting of Merseyside MPs in the House on the day prior to going into the House of Commons, prior to the debate beginning. And he said, oh, that's a brilliant idea, I'll get them together. That lasted until, this was ongoing, I kept ringing him all week. By the Friday afternoon, prior to the Monday and the debate, his secretary rang me and said, oh, Steve said he won't be able to arrange that, it's far too difficult to get them together. So we went down to the House of Commons under our own steam, and were kind of invited in by Tom Watson's secretary, who I have to say she was really good at accommodating people, because you know it's not easy for me, but it's like I'm one step removed from this. I didn't lose anyone at Hillsborough, and even though I've been immersed in it for so many years, I can be quite hard nosed because I've had to be in things. But I was going down there with families that I first knew in 1989. Those that are left, a lot of them are dead. And I saw how fragile and frail they were, and I saw what the years had done to them. And I saw them, you know, yet again, were taking a trip. And, you know, that's how my friendship with them was formed, on train journeys over the years. And it was a big deal for them, you know, and it was awful. I mean, they have no illusions about things, but they always hope to retain this hope. Anyway, we got to the House of Commons, and we were kind of, they were looked after by Tom Watson's secretary while I was busy doing things. There was no meeting beforehand, and we went straight into the House. The debate, which wasn't a debate because there was no discussion, opened with Steve Rotherham basically saying the history of it, that he was a Hillsborough and whatever. And very eloquent. I'm not sure who wrote it for him. Without being nasty, I doubt very much that he wrote it himself, because his opening shot normally is, "I'm just a brickie from Kirby, and if I can do it, anyone can." It is, you know, he's big into meritocracy, and but I wouldn't take away that it was his experience. He was at Hillsborough, so I would never take that away from him. I do kind of wonder where he was for years, because, you know, and his emerging political career, because when he was Lord Mayor and the freedom of the city was given to families, he was so like one dimensional that I got onto him and went, "You're leaving families out." No, I've got all the names from the family support group, and all our families have been ignored and weren't getting the freedom of the city, and we corrected it, but not, you know, it's the issue about being excluded. So from that, he set the trend there. He spoke, and from then on, what followed was 4 hours of backslapping and self-congratulatory. They all thanked each other for the wonderful speech, how wonderful it was. And what annoyed me with that was, I was angry with the emotion that I saw displayed in the House, because emotion gets you nowhere. There was opportunities for questions to be asked there, and nobody raised it. And I'll give you one example, which is the MP for Sheffield South, Clive Betts. He got up and he spoke, and he was in tears about, you know, how he was, you know, he'd been at the ground, and, you know, his experience of it, and how he was leader of Sheffield City Council at the time of the disaster, and, you know, anything he could do, and he'd hand papers over if he could. Not one person stood up and said to him, "You were leader of the council at the time. Why didn't the Hillsborough ground have a valid safety certificate? It was under your watch. It was on your watch." And all those things, because of the emotion. Alison McGovern, another Merseyside MP from Wirral, actually, she had it all going for her in terms of the emotion stakes, because she was heavily pregnant and had to hold her hand to keep the paper still, because it was shaken. And she was genuinely emotional. But if you really want to help people, you've got to put your emotions to one side and deal in facts. And all that was reiterated, the whole thing in the House of Commons could have been done in 20 minutes. People sat for over 4 hours whilst the same thing was repeated time and time again. All offering sympathy, very few. There was a few where there was some contribution, which was okay. Mark Durkin actually made a contribution, which I was pleased at, because he'd said something that I'd said for years, which was the comparisons in terms of longevities of campaigns with the Bloody Sunday. And he was saying, you know, there's people in my constituency who can empathise. It was the first time in the whole thing where it was put in context. You know, this is what people have to go through. And I was really pleased about that happened. But basically, everyone came out of that House of Commons debate going, yeah, we've got what we wanted. This is great. All the papers are going to be released. Because what I should have said was, after when the petition was gathering momentum and we kicked off about the government appealing, it was announced by the government, and they did do this thing whereby they said they were quite okay about all documents being released to the panel. So that was their way of saying, look, forget about that one thing with freedom of information. This will have to get, you know, we'll let it all to the panel. And the joke in that is, of course, the Hillsborough Justice Campaign, because of pushing this e-petition, because of, you know, kicking off about the appeal, has created a set of circumstances whereby the panel now has access to more information than it would have originally had. But we haven't, and we've been written out of the whole thing. When we came back, I got phone calls. I came back separately because I'd done an interview. I came back separately from London, and I was on the train, and I was getting phone calls from families who'd gone home earlier saying, "Have you seen the Echo?" And the Echo was about 8 pages, and we got a line in it whereby they quoted Steve Kelly, who lost his brother Michael at Hillsborough, and who'd been in London with us, and they got his brother's name wrong. They called him Andrew. There wasn't even an Andrew, you know. But it was no relevance to, it wasn't in context of the role we'd played. But also, more importantly, the pictures showed a meeting before the debate in the House of the committee of the family support group with the MPs. The meeting that I had asked for the families, which was told couldn't go ahead, went ahead, but without our families. So you have our families in the House of Commons, and there's the meeting, and they were ignored. And I'm saying that to show that if the differences are taking place like that, what are they being left out of again? And something else which I didn't say was that we found out by accident, going back to September, when we knew there was going to be a debate, when the e-petition had reached its number, etc. Anne Williams, who is, as I said, has her own group, she was asked to do an interview for the One Show, and they wanted to film her on the pitch. And so she arrived at Anfield, and she said to the security man, I'm one of the Hillsborough families. And the guy said to her, the security guy went, "Oh, upstairs. Right, first room on the right, whatever." So she thought she was going to meet the television people. She walked in on a meeting of the panel. the Home Office and the Family Support Group, and they went sick. Now, we only know this. We only know about that meeting because she had the decency to tell us. She looked, she walked out, she went, wrong room. And the Home Office woman went running after her, and trying to make contact. So she rang our group and told us this. So we went, whoa, we're going to go public on this. So we went public on it. So you would think that there would be some attempt made by the panel and the Home Office to say, oh, look, you've got this wrong, whatever. Not at all. Not at all. No contact. And the other thing I should say, since July, when the appeal, when the Commissioner's ruling was first announced, there was no contact between the panel, the Home Office, and our campaign, save for two telephone calls, one I initiated, and one whereby the Home Office woman rang me to say the government are appealing, which I'd already known because I'd just come from doing an interview about it. So there was no contact made. And so what happened was, we obviously were very concerned about that and wrote to the panel saying we were very, very concerned on a number of issues. We were concerned at the lack of impartiality on a panel member because he had attended interviews with family support group members. He was part of the meeting that was at Anfield, even though he's not part of that subcommittee. And we also said, why didn't we have a similar meeting? And why didn't Anne Williams have a similar meeting? By way of response, the bishop replied to the Justice Campaign. The bishop is the chair of the panel. And he replied to another family member separately. And guess who got the blame? Me. What was said was the Home Office woman had left a message with me asking me to set up a meeting. Not true. Not true at all. In fact, in the initial letter to the bishop, we made reference to my phone calls with this Home Office person. So I was like, wow, this is picking off here. This is trying to pick me off. And also it went to someone else as well where I was named. So in my own, in a personal capacity, I wrote to the bishop and said, this isn't true. And I want you to say, you know, this isn't true. And I want you to go to the other members of the panel, if you've told them that, and tell them. And I also want you to go to the families that you've told and tell them. By way of response, and this is sort of bringing it up to date a bit, by way of response, because I emailed it to the Home Office saying I wanted them to pass it round, my letter. She emailed me saying, oh, the bishop's very concerned to resolve this. He'd like to invite you to a meeting of you and with you and him in Bishop's Lodge, and his secretary will be ringing you. Then I received an email from the bishop, but again, just in which he said he made, well, basically, it's awful to do because, but basically, you know, never use an illness. I wouldn't use it. If you're not up to a job, don't do it. That sounds a little bit hard, I know, but the bishop had a heart surgery for a few months, but we were informed about 6 months ago or more, we were informed by the Home Office it wouldn't make any difference, that everything would continue. So of course, when I write to the bishop, I'm writing to him, I'm addressing him as the chair of the panel, and so I'm addressing all the panel as well. And so I wrote asking for why he'd said that when it wasn't true. And I'll just give you the first line back of how he answered me. If we can find it, but basically just saying, dear Sheila, when I was given the unpleasant news that I had to have heart surgery, the one question I asked my cardiothoracic surgeon was, will I be able to continue with Hillsborough? I am relieved to say that 4 months on, I have been told I can. I'd never use an illness. I'd never use that. That's emotional blackmail as far as I'm concerned. And it cuts no ice. I mean, and, you know, I did reply saying I was pleased his health had recovered from major surgery. And I hope he was aware that when I wrote to him, I did so in his capacity as chair of the panel and meant it, all the panel should be involved. But that's the kind of response. And the response was, I asked questions and he didn't answer it. He said, as you know from earlier conversations and from our terms of reference, I have valued the meetings that I and my colleagues have had with the Hillsborough Justice Campaign, we're there for everybody. He doesn't make any reference to the specific points. And could I arrange a meeting? And then his secretary rang and said, the bishop wants a meeting. So I think it's a bishop, a meeting with me to discuss the contents of my letter. And I said, well, is it with me or is it with the group? And so she said, oh, I just checked it. Oh, no, it's not with you. It's a meeting of life with the group. So he's ignored it and hoped it's gone on. So I've just written him another letter. So basically, we're existing in parallel universe where you say black, he says white. And now he's because I've pushed this, the secretary is trying to set up a phone interview with me. He won't put it in writing that he lied, basically. And you know, it's unfair. It's unfair to me because the one way you can attack me is to attack my honesty and my integrity. It kind of, because, you know, like a lot of people here, I suppose, you pay a high price for it and you make a lot of sacrifices along the way. Anyway, to bring it up to date, the government said that it didn't want the information of the cabinet minutes, the meeting, released under freedom of information because it was just one bit of something. Our guess was that it would play havoc with the state funeral for Margaret Thatcher, and they want Thatcher dead first. The other thing I would put is that basically, there's, you know, that gets released, there's nothing to stop them. A freedom of information request for the minutes of the meeting held under Tony Blair for the Iraq War, you know. So it would have consequences. I didn't buy any of the excuses. I just think if the information is there, people have waited so long, it should be brought out. It should be brought out there and then. This week I received a phone call from the Liverpool Echo saying, do you know about these tissue samples? And I didn't. And basically a story had been leaked to them that at the time of the post-mortems, into the autopsies, tissue samples were taken in some of the victims. Now, that's not unusual, and it's certainly not illegal. The issue is one of retention, retaining the tissue samples. And now I know the law has changed where the people would be required now to know this, but in 1989 it wasn't the case. And that, why were they taken? And also this was never brought out at the inquest, which is you know, supposed to inquire fully into the deaths of these individuals. As soon as I had that phone call, I rang the Home Office and they were clearly flapping. And I went, oh, once again, families have to find out from the front page of the Echo stories that are being leaked. She said that they had found, they'd discovered this. This was discovered in 10 families. So they felt the need to write to the families to tell them this. So I was prepared to think it was one of the families that had leaked the story. Not so. I spoke to the person who it was leaked to, and he won't tell me who leaked it, but it wasn't any of the families, because they're hounding me, thinking I know who the families are and will I give a name. And I've said, no, I don't, but even if I did, I wouldn't tell you, because it's not my business any more than it's any of your business. It's extremely personal in the sense of that, and it would add nothing. It's salacious. Knowing who the family is wouldn't make any difference. Where it's an issue is that it should have been raised at the inquest. The panel were forced to come out with a statement saying it was unfortunate that it was leaked, and the reasons the tissue samples were taken was that in those 10 victims, they didn't display signs of traumatic asphyxia, which puts paid to the notion that everyone died of traumatic asphyxia and was dead more or less at the same time. So there were people, you know, over the years, and it made me think, you know, people were saying to me, when I saw our Peter or our Stones, there wasn't a mark on him. And normally, you know, you'd expect petechial hemorrhages on traumatic, you know, little blood on people with traumatic asphyxia. The other issue, of course, and relevant to what I'm trying to get across, is it makes a mockery and totally negates the government's appeal. The government saying it didn't want information released piecemeal, it wanted it in context, has now chosen to write letters to 10 families, which has been leaked, and I think it's been leaked from inside, and that's what I'm being told. And totally negates the appeal, and I think they should withdraw the appeal. As far as I'm aware, the appeal is still ongoing and is due to be heard in February, and I think we need to put pressure you know, to kind of basically to back the BBC up on defending this, if it, because there's an issue here that goes against a time and exercise of information being released. The panel are saying they will report in the summer of next year, but like David said before, what they will report, and it'll be in they're saying it's in context, but it's their version. And I know if it was my son, my husband, I would want this firsthand. Families in our group are very dissatisfied with the way things are moving. One of them rang Sheffield on last Wednesday, and Sheffield Library, and said he wanted to know before he bothered driving down what information was held there, and that he would have access to it in relation to his son. You know, he'd lost his son at Hillsborough, and he was told he couldn't have access to it. No one could have access to it except the Hillsborough panel and anyone working for them. So again, families are having their rights denied. I'm going to check into that more, because I believe that if it's in the public library, they're actually breaching all sorts of codes there that they shouldn't be doing. And information that might have been there previously is now being held back. So that's the kind of thing where we're at. And I just want to say you might be going, well, look, it's going to come out in the summer, and you know, why, in terms of a time and exercise, why bother, you know, pushing the freedom of information? I'll tell you why, and it's something that's really, really close to me from being involved in this as an academic researcher in 1989. One of the first people I got to know was a man who lost his son, and a man named John Glover. And his three sons were there. One son got out and was trying to get back in to get his brother out, but didn't succeed because the police pulled him off, and the brother died. The lad who had survived, who had been in the pen, used to go missing after Hillsborough, and you'd find him lying on his brother's gravestone, traumatised for 10 years, absolutely in a terrible state. Was actually beginning to get his life together again and get was becoming more proactive. He was part and parcel of founding the Justice Campaign because of the way him and his family had been treated. And 10 years after Hillsborough, we just held the boycott of the Hillsborough ground on the Saturday, and I was with him and I'd never seen him looking so happy, and we had a great time, whatever. And on the Monday, he started his first job on the Monday morning since Hillsborough. And on that Monday morning, he was crushed to death, like a Greek tragedy. He was moving, transporting marble slabs, and he was in the back of a van with his mate. And as it went round a corner, the slabs weren't secured properly. And the slab was falling on his friend, and he pushed his friend out of the way, and he was crushed to death 10 years after his brother was crushed to death. It really is like Greek tragedy of that proportions. John Glover, his father, carried on fighting. I've seen the family go through so many that you might say they're an unlucky family, I don't know. John's health has suffered terribly. I was last with him outside of his house when I went to meet Steve Rotherham, the MP, and brought families, and John wasn't there, and I was disappointed, and I said, I'm sorry, John Glover was supposed to be coming, but I know he's ill, and his grandson is very ill. Anyway, John turned up, and I looked at him, and I went, oh my God, you're dying, and I could just see it in him. But he was really distressed because his grandson was so ill. Anyway, we dropped him off at home, and afterwards he was rushed into hospital with pneumonia, where they then diagnosed that he had lung cancer, and there was nothing they could do for him. And I went to see him the other week because he's dying, and he's dying at home. And I had one of the most fulfilling 3 hours. And it sounds bizarre because he was... It's very working class, and it's very much, I lost my own mother last year, and it's very much like my mother would not be, she went into a hospice and she went, get me out of here, everyone's dying, I don't want to be around dying people. And I understand that, I really do. And we had to bring her home, and she wouldn't go in a bed, she'd only lie on the couch until right at the end. She was like, if I'm not in a bed, I'm not sick. It was the psychology of it all. And she drove us crazy. It really was hard. But that, and I went to John Glover's, and there he was lying on the couch. And it was like, just like... And anyway, he managed to sit up when I was there. And And I was sitting with him for ages, and then he said he was very tired, and I went, well, John, you know, rest. He went, I can't, Sheila, you're on my bed, you know, and I have to get up. I forgot I was on his bed. So I got up, and I sat in a chair, and I looked at him asleep on the couch, and he's dying. And in the chair opposite me was his 13-year-old grandson, who was showing me his own chemotherapy driver in his chest and tube in his stomach. He has a very aggressive throat cancer that has come back twice and he's had tumours removed. He's dying. This kid might die. He might survive. And you go, and you know what? And the family are there. And I had the best few hours because I felt I was amongst real people, and I was amongst people who went through in the face of adversity. Don't give up. And that's why I feel so strongly about this freedom of information. The panel saying, well, what do you want the information for? You can have it all. John Glover is going to die without ever knowing what was in them cabinet minutes. And John Glover has been at the forefront of fighting the whole Hillsborough issue since 1989. His health has suffered as a consequence. The panel could have just stepped back, and John Glover would have at least felt he'd got some satisfaction. And that's not much. He deserved it. And at the beginning of the week, I got an email of someone else, and one of our members of our group, a survivor, his friend, who's done a lot for us, and who's also a Hillsborough, committed suicide last weekend. He's 38. You know, all you keep hearing about are people dying, and they're dying not knowing, because, you know, there's red tape put in the way. And that's why I feel so angry, and that's why I feel that the panel could have done so much, and saddens me because as individuals, the Hillsborough documentary that Jimmy McGovern did years ago, John Glover is one of the Glover family, one of the families covered in that. And people know he's in ill health, and that is so, so sad that he will die without, you know, he's going to die in the next few days probably, without that being known. And that's why I feel so strongly about it. That's about it really, other than to say that when the family support group met with the panel in the Home Office in September, it was at Liverpool Football's ground, and those of you who know, you could actually spit from our shop to the ground. We can wave to each other. We are opposite, we are neighbours. And yet they didn't think it. And the idea that I was used as an excuse, what sort of, you know, Home Office officials, firstly, didn't leave a message, but even if they had, if no one had got back to them, email, letter, formally ring this is allegedly on my private phone, not like to the Hillsborough campaign shop. So the arguments just don't hold water. So basically, what I was just trying to point out there is that there is still differential treatment, and that it gets caught up in a smokescreen of emotion, and everyone's in this view. And the information, and yes, a lot of information will come out because it's gone beyond legal action. That's why they let the information out now. It's gone beyond legal action. So that's about it, really. But I'm happy to answer any questions anyone might have. I didn't think it was worthwhile going over the history of Hillsborough because I know I did a lot of that last time, and I do recognise people from last time. So, but thank you very much anyway, and thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
I just wanted to say one thing.
Yeah.
Just I'll talk about what happened with me and the panel as well. I want to say, just to give some people some background about why there is this differentiation between the support group and the two other groups, is the support group has always been prepared to accept what they were told, whereas the other two groups have never been prepared to accept what they're told. Now, to understand what the groups know that is true, which is not being acknowledged, that I know through my, because I was at the ground as a witness, the official line is that the disaster started and finished at 3:04, but anyone who was at the ground with a good view knew that at 2:40 there were people injured and struggling to escape. What people are there also knew is that the police pushed escaping people back into the crowds, and that has never been said formally anywhere, and all video and photographic evidence of that has been covered up. What people who are there also know is that after 3:04,
that the rescue attempt was carried out almost entirely by fans, and in the face of opposition from the police, the fans had to battle the police to carry out the rescue. The police stopped the ambulances coming onto the pitch. They stopped the fans clearing space for treatment to the injured. They tried to stop the fans ripping up advertising boards to be used as stretchers. And when they backed away from that, and the fans were ferrying injured people the length of the pitch to reach the blocked ambulances, the police formed a security cordon across the halfway line to block them. And what is also known, and is also not said, is that whilst the police were praised immediately in the aftermath of their rescue attempt, the entire rescue attempt was carried out by the fans. And what the police were doing from that point onwards was carrying out a perversion of the course of justice, a destruction of evidence. And rather than helping what was going on the pitch, there was destruction of evidence. And the reason why they will always go and seek out the support group when the support group aren't even asking for anything.
That's right. Yeah,
they've never asked for anything. No, for years and years, they said their campaign was... Every time the Hillsborough Justice campaign wins a new stage, they seek out the support group and put them ahead of the justice group because they will know that they will accept what they were told as the solution. And that is why they're not dealing with the two groups. What happened with me is similar to Sheila, is that they were constantly trying to take me out to lunch. They were constantly trying to buy me tickets to travel to see them. And constantly, and this is presumably what they succeeded on with the support group, was hotel tickets, yes. OBEs, Queen's Garden parties,
yes.
particularly the people who run the support group, and bought these people off. And they were trying to do that with me right from the outset. And that was one reason why I was never going to be acceptable. But the line they used was because I was a witness and had seen what was happening. They said that I was unsuitable for the panel, presumably because the last thing you want on the panel is someone who actually knows what happens. Because if you actually say, no, the police did push people back into the crowd, I saw it, then that's disastrous
for
them.
That goes to the economics of it as well, how much this whole thing is costing. Because I just... And I'll tell you this, because this really offended me. At the Justice Campaign, we're all unpaid volunteers, and, you know, we give our skills and our time where and when we can. And that's because that's our politics. Anne Ridley, this Home Office woman who's, you know, sort of wants to be my best mate, really. And she kind of, she how's the family? What's this? You know, I've got mates. I don't need new mates, you know. And kind of but anyway, she'd ring me up and say stuff. And she said, well, I used to be an accountant, she said. But then I got divorced and I went into the homeless. And she's retired. She said, I'm past retiring age, she said. But when Ken offered me this, and he's the head Home Office guy, he did a lot of stuff with the asylum stuff. When he asked me to do this, I thought, well, why not, she said. He's a great boss. I've worked for him before. It's only for 2 years. It's me holiday money for 2 years. And she said that to me. And I was on the other end of a phone. And I just wanted to cry, because after all this fighting, that's what someone is so thick-skinned they could say that. It was, why say that kind of thing? And what Daniel is saying is so true about police. Andy Burnham, actually, in the House of Commons, read out a police statement of a young cop on the day who said his experience of what happened. And no one was giving us directions, no one was giving us instructions what to do. And a senior officer had written in the side, go back to him, this needs to be removed, this needs to be removed. And, you know, it's there. And still, when we pointed that out to, when there was a scrutiny under Lord Justice Stuart Smith, and this was when Jack Straw was home. No, they were in opposition then. Yeah, they were in opposition.
Promised Hillsborough Justice Campaign a scrutiny if Labour got elected.
Yes, yeah.
And then the first thing he did was appoint the country's most right-wing judge.
That's right, yes. Well, he promised an inquiry and then gave a scrutiny, and it was the terms of reference are important there. And he said in the House of Commons, oh, we believe you that the police changed statements, and just to prove it, we've put it in the report, we've put the original and the doctored one. And that was when you saw the society altering to the point where MPs and, you know, people in positions of authority would have been ousted years ago. You know, you sort of laugh when you think of the Profumo scandal, you know, sort of what politicians ride now in terms of scandals. That it's, yeah, well, we lied, but they lied, but it's okay, wouldn't have made any difference, was what was said. And that is what is so so offensive. But the idea that this is costing so much money, and it is costing a lot of money, they've given us nothing, we've given them a lot in terms of contacts. I personally, because they didn't have information for families that weren't in the family support group, weren't in our group, but because I've been around a long time and could access a lot of people or new people, I personally gave them addresses of an awful lot of people. But they, you know, so they've used us, but it's been one-way traffic all along the way. And I think, you know, Daniel is spot on that there was no way they would have him on the panel, because basically, how could they come back and go, well, no, you're not saying that? Because how could they refute the evidence of someone who was there on the day? But they can do that. And if we could just take it, something I did forget to say.
So
when
I ask a question, yes, on that, is this panel only reviewing documentation? It doesn't plan to go and interview. It's not conducting interviews.
I challenged the Bishop on this precisely. It's my third meeting, which was the apology, you're not appointed, but we still want to talk to you. I said, there is a mass of witness evidence. There were 40,000 people in that stadium. We saw exactly what happened. And I told him exactly what I've told you now. And I wrote it out for them, including the bit about the police shutting the gates,
yes,
in the face of fans. I said, there are people who will tell you this, but the police would have never taken statements from these people because it wasn't the evidence they were seeking. It wasn't the investigation they were carrying out. They were investigating whether the fans were drunk, whether they'd turned out without tickets, whether they were looking for evidence that would get them off the hook. I said, you will not find statements of this because no one ever took that evidence. And I said, I can get you people who will give you the evidence. And so it's got to be written down. He says, I'll get you people who have written it down. Hillsborough Justice Campaign has my witness statement is on it. It's hosted on a website in Holland, by the way, because there's a police federation injunction that prevents it being hosted on a website in this country, because it tells the truth about Hillsborough.
They were taking us to pretty
well. What actually are their grounds for... They obviously don't say that as their justification.
They don't want to look at that evidence.
But how can they... But on what grounds can they...
They say their evidence is public documents. Well, the Police Federation get that injunction. They get it because they've got a lot of money, and who's going to resist them?
Right.
They say that people are slandering and libelling the senior police officers.
What was happening when we had it here? They were when we had it here, when it was hosted here, the server would pull the plug because they were frightened.
Sure.
So where we have it now, people are prepared to be challenged. Although they actually haven't been.
But the election
lies on some questions.
Yeah.
Sense.
I missed the beginning of the talk, unfortunately. So at the end, you said that. Were you saying it's now beyond the statute of limitations?
For a lot of things. Our belief is that and this is what I think. The family support group, three members of the committee met with Alan Johnson when he was Home Secretary and reached an agreement which they won't tell anyone about. And one of the things I think that they reached an agreement was they would be happy, they would be content if this is reported in some way and put to bed, well, they say archived. And this is actually called the Hillsborough Memorial Archive, that's what it's called. It's archiving material, and so it's going through papers. There's this panel who, you know, sort of, they appointed archivists, they appointed researchers, and I've got an issue over how the researchers were appointed.
Police researchers.
Well, the thing how the researchers were appointed, and it actually goes to the heart of it, of someone I worked with on Hillsborough Stuff, who's a panel member. Phil Scraton, who is at Queen's University in Belfast now. And we were told, I asked when I found out researchers were appointed, I said, how were they appointed? And they said, oh, it was advertised publicly. Then it was only when I was speaking to Martin Rosenbaum, he said something about Phil Scraton, and I said, well, can I ask you why you went to him out of all the people on the panel? He said, well, he was the easiest to access, and it's his researchers that are doing the work. I said, oh no, you must be making a mistake. He went, no, I'm not. So I looked into it, and when I looked into it, I found the job applications for the researchers, and the application this Phil Scraton is a member of the panel, and his the positions were advertised within the law from the law faculty of Queen's where he works, and it's called the Hillsborough Project. It's actually the name of a project I initially worked on in 89 with him, the Hillsborough Project, and you will be under the instruction of Phil Scraton. So we pointed out to the bishop that we felt there was a conflict of interest and there was a duality in his role, and basically he said that's a load of rubbish. But I don't think it is, because, and that then goes to the question I asked at the very first meeting, a guarantee that no one will benefit professionally from information they had access to. So you see the book will be here shortly.
Right. So. Not this show.
Yeah, well, you see what, well, you know, so, and just, and we believe the information's coming out because basically there's agreement being reached. Publish, say it was wrong, there was a cover-up, but we won't take any action. I believe the family support group said we won't take any action. That's not the, and I don't know what action people can take, and we won't know to the time. But if I could just very briefly go back to a point, because it's relevant to what Daniel said about evidence that the and what the panel have taken and what they will won't take. I was contacted in September by a guy who emailed me first, and I was like, oh, sometimes stuff looks a bit, you know, cranky and whatever. But then I looked at it, and then I emailed and asked him for a phone number. The guy was the former forensic intelligence analysis officer for South Yorkshire Police. That was the police force. He wasn't there at the time of Hillsborough, but subsequently, it's an interesting story, because he was sacked by South Yorkshire Police because he wouldn't sign off the terrorist threat, because he said, "I am not saying that the Muslims in this area and in that area are the threat, and this information that I am being asked to sign off is actually coming from government sources." So he was sacked. And took a case against them and lost. They are doing what they do great, what they did with the two police officers after Hillsborough who chose to try and speak out. They make out he's a crank. It's easy to do when, you know, and because he adheres strictly to this. His reason for contacting us was the former press officer from South Yorkshire Police had been the chief press officer at the time of Hillsborough, was still working there when this guy, Tony, was there, and he remembers mentioning, you know, Hillsborough's mentioned time and about, but he didn't do anything about it, and he says it's to his shame he didn't. And I've subsequently met with this guy because I've got him to come to Liverpool with people, because I wanted to see, are we being played here, because it was before the House of Commons debate. Do people want us to go public on this and we're made to look fools? But I do believe him. He told me that this guy, the press officer, on the day of the disaster, went to the control room to see what was going on, and his way was barred. They wouldn't let him in. He says, "I've got a right to come in here," and he forced his way in. When he got in, the Assistant Chief Constable of South Yorkshire, Walter Jackson, who was not on duty that day, had been there as a guest of the club, so you can imagine, wined and dined. He had gone to the control room to see what was going on. His evidence in Taylor says, to the Taylor inquiry says, Walter Jackson went to the control room to see what was going on. He was told by Chief Superintendent Duckenfield that the fans had burst the gate open, a lie. He went down to check for himself, came back up and assumed control. He did this, all this stuff. The press officer says when he forced his way into the control room, Walter Jackson, the same person who in Taylor inquiry was under the table, rocking like a baby. Had totally lost it, and was just, and he said the image of it had stayed with him. So I found out from Tony Farrell that he said, "I've come to you." He said, "I don't know why no one wants to touch this information. I mean, I met with the family support group." He spoke first with Trevor Hicks, then he spoke to the chair of the family support group, and she took him to the Echo, Steve, which is relevant to your stuff. The Echo interviewed him at length, whatever, and then ditched the story. Obviously, didn't do the story. He wrote sworn statements to the family support group. who have never done anything with it. So we contacted the panel via the bishop and said, we want you to interview the man who told us, the man who told him, who's the press officer, and the former assistant chief constable, because it goes to the heart of everything here. This is what was said in the Taylor inquiry. This is what this person said. At the very least, you need to interview these people. And the response from the bishop, and this is what we're saying, we're speaking in a parallel universe. Basically, we wanted those people. We believe that the seriousness of the statement warrants further investigation. The response from the bishop was, finally, you raise an issue regarding information provided by a former employee of the South Yorkshire Police. That's all he says, because then what he says, the panel is aware of this issue and reaffirms its commitment to full disclosure of documents, demonstrating how the documents disclosed add to public understanding of the disaster. Public understanding of the disaster, that's what they're about, presenting a perception of an understanding. But that is not an answer. He does not say, no, we won't, yes, we will. And when I've pushed on it, I've been told, well, it's we're not interviewing people. And yet I know that Steve Rotherham, the MP, has given them loads of information for people to see. So all the time, they're selective who they will interview. And, you know, I know that, you know, Daniel, they've never got back in touch with you, have they, Daniel?
They said they would do about getting them documents, witness statements, which they could therefore review because they were documents, and they could only look at documents, and they 10 months ago, not
But even this fits into that criteria, because I'm talking about evidence from the Taylor inquiry documented, and a statement from this, and I wanted to know the statement, I wanted Walter Jackson's statement from the day, and the press officer's statement of the day, because he will have made one. And this guy is being pilloried by South Yorkshire Police. His own story is an interesting one. I'll tell you his name and stuff. The guy's name is Tony Farrell. The same guy, to be honest, of his own volition, came down the House of Commons and sat there, you know, throughout the whole debate. There was nothing in it for him other than, you know, trying to offer us support. So.
Any more? Thanks for that, Sheila. There's 2 points. The first one that thank you for is the day of the debate in the House of Commons. I felt quite ill. And I felt quite ill because a whole group of Labour MPs popped up from nowhere who I've never even heard of before. All backslapping and coming out with these stories about Hillsborough. And you're right about this MP Steve Rotherham. I've never even heard of him, bumped into him, no links at all with the local Labour movement, parachuted into a safe Labour seat, and now he's like this fount of all knowledge. Never off the TV, the radio, and I found it quite distasteful, debate. But I was scared to say anything because I didn't know whether it was me being pernickety or you're just scared to mention it to anyone in case you start biting your head off. It wasn't and then the stuff about Phil Scrape, this is where egos now are running away with the actual story. Egos of an MP, egos of a criminologist, whatever he is, over in Queens and Belfast, who will, come what may, reap the benefits of what's going on with him. One final point, Sheila. Do you detect any changes in terms of how some of the more serious papers are dealing with Hillsborough? Because I remember a few months ago reading
an article in The Guardian, the ex-political editor, who's always been very sarcastic and, you know, wishy-washy, lefty. And he put on his blog that he was quite appalled at what had come out in terms of where the police were being told to change the stories because their sergeant had said, we're being made to look bad here. The fans shouldn't be doing this. We should be doing it. So change your story. And he actually said that's what's brought him back around to this whole question of justice in terms of Hillsborough. But the duty tech and overall see change within the press, or is it just a passing?
I think really, I think Daniel hit on it, because he said that no matter what we do, and if something comes off, then the press always go to the family support group, and the establishment always go to them, because they accept and they don't challenge. And increasingly, it's what I term brand Hillsborough. Hillsborough's been branded, and it's extremely offensive. People who know the score, even within the media, some journalists, you know, I mean, I won't name them, but people who really buy into it, and did they buy it? I'm like, do you really believe that, or are you too frightened now because you've got a vested interest not to challenge things? And it's very disappointing, and it's the odd thing that will creep out. And sometimes, like over the freedom of information stuff and the e-petition, The Guardian were quite good. There was a freelance who did something, and she did it great. And I said, look, you know, I'm sick of giving me time because you misquote all that. But she did a great job, this person. And by the afternoon, I'd noticed that money had gone into our PayPal. And I said, I know that name. And it was the same person. So I emailed her and I went, you've just given us your fee for that article. And she went, I couldn't take money from it. And I was just so moved by the gesture, you know, someone really decent. And then someone else, and I forget now, from The Guardian, quoted me, and, you know, sort of more or less said, and it's as Sheila Coleman said, and interestingly enough, I appeared as a clarification. Scraton had to have the last word. He'd come in behind me, and what he was saying wasn't even strictly true, but he must have put so much pressure on them. And you use the word ego, and that's it, because I know he will have been the driving force behind the panel and the freedom of information, because he's got to be the first kid off the block, because it's ego. It's the ex-Catholic priest syndrome, and it's the adoration, wanting to be adored. You know the score and the book. And and this person is just, you know, sort of with the family support group, and I'm saying that's fine, but give us someone on the panel. Well, that's what we were saying. It's gone beyond that now. So we're very disappointed with the whole setup.
Yeah, this is a bit of a more abstract question, but I mean, you know, obviously you point out the connections with Bloody Sunday, and yeah, we know all about, like, the amount of people have been murdered in police custody, and the fact that no one's ever, you know, no policeman, as far as I'm aware, has been really convicted of that. And you're talking about hundreds of people we know, potentially questions about how they died. And anyway, in Tomlinson, and you've got, like, Demented, and all this stuff. I wonder, what do you actually think about why the, and I use this word loosely, the state is so interested in trying to obfuscate, delay, tire you out, break up families through years and years of having to deal with, you know, getting justice. Why do you think the state does that? Wouldn't it be more in its interest to actually, like, pick those people out and say, right, yeah, there was a mistake, these people are responsible, you know, and actually, in the long run, that might be a better strategy for them.
I've actually said that to people over the years, basically saying to them, you know, when are you going to learn that, you know, cover-ups don't work at this level? What, you totally underestimate the resilience of people who feel they have to know the truth, and especially when someone died. And you know, you said about, you know, deaths in custody, and you know, there was something the other week about, I mean, the number of deaths in custody, in police custody, for, and it doesn't get any better. And I remember being at sort of meetings of inquest years ago where people, and you go, oh, it's breaking, something's got to give, and it still happens. And it's like they don't learn. And I sometimes go, well, I don't know the answer, because I ask the same question as you, and but we're operating from a point of view of common sense. We're saying it would be easier to give to just give these people, you know, had this been resolved early on. Yes, it was the police, you know, Lord Justice Taylor said it was police responsibility, and if what followed on from there was accountability and liability for it, for the collective body of the police, not for individuals, they could deal with that in-house whatever way, but for the collective body, for the police, South Yorkshire Police as an organisation. Most of the families that I've ever met through Hillsborough, you wouldn't term them political. They've become politicised through the process. John Glover, who I mentioned, who is dying, he's like, you know, sort of, if you saw John, I mean, he's all the years I've known him, he's never had a tooth in his head. I'm sure he's got a set of false teeth somewhere, but he didn't like it. He had the best Bobby Charlton hairdo. He used to be a bus driver and a lorry driver. This guy is just an average working class Liverpool man, poorly educated, who within a short space of time was hounding me, ringing me up, wanting to talk about Lord Keith of Kinkle and the House of Lord Rulon on pre-death trauma. He'd have never known anything like that. He's become educated, he's become politicised, and so many people have, and that's where it backfires. And then, I don't know that there's attempts to pick you off, there's attempts. I can go back now, I mean, I'll throw this into the frame because it's the sun, and it never occurred to me until someone brought it, because it is going back so far now, and certainly technology wasn't where it was. But in the early days after Hillsborough, the notorious Sun headline, and by the way, there's some leaflets there just with that, we, you know, Sun boycott goes on. When we started challenging the after the accidental death verdicts in the at the inquest, six families wanted to appeal. There's no money. The lawyers had taken the money and run, and I got people I knew to kind of called in to help. And we took it for leave for judicial review. And when I was working with those six families, my house was broken into. Nothing was taken, only an address book and other personal things, whatever. The six families and me, our phones were just ridiculous. Something happened with my phone, which I didn't even know my phone had been off till someone told me, because she couldn't get me, and she'd been told that she was given a reason. And it was only when I was like, when all this hacking stuff come about, I was thinking, clearly the phones were tapped. That's no two ways about it. I've always assumed that the police were tapping the phones. But in light of the sun and everything like that, I did actually begin to think, were they being tapped by someone other than the police? In which case, we might have been at the forefront of it all, and maybe. But seriously, if I was to get you the families up to, you know, sort of the incidences that happened with the phones and with our phones, as we were leading up to going to the High Court for appeal. You do begin to think, where you sort of at the beginning of the hacking stuff, or was it more mainstream police tapping the phone? But they were the sort of things that happened. And so at that stage, you make a decision. You either go, oh, I can't handle this, and I've got family, I've got responsibilities. I mean, no, my son was only young, but you know, it's probably like a lot of people here, it's like, you're not going to scare me. Because you can't give in to it. I mean, it's, you know, when I was in Sheffield, and the West Midlands police that were the investigating force used to follow me around, till in the end I turned around and I went, look, I'll tell you who I am. You tell me who you are. Let's sit down and I'll tell you what I'm doing here. Because I wasn't going to be put in that position of feeling under pressure of someone following me. And they admitted they were following me. They admitted
I asked this, the question you asked. I asked this question to the bishop and Ken, the civil service guy, in the final meeting I had with them. I said, why are you trying to keep out the Hillsborough Justice Campaign? Do you not understand that they are not a tiny membership organisation that you can buy off? they have no membership, they have no body, they are the people, they are the ones who at all times have brought the pressure on this, and that until you deal with them and their demands, this will never end. But it's the name of the shop is the Many-Headed Hydra. The whole point is that the establishment keeps trying to chop off heads, and they don't understand that the more you go around chopping heads, the more heads appear. And I said, you know, we're only just getting into this. We're only just hitting our stride on this now. You know, there were people who were teenagers in their 20s who saw this, and are only now just getting the confidence and the voice to say what they've heard. You know, this, you cannot buy this off. This will not go away. And they do that thing where they sort of defocus slightly and look over your shoulder as you're talking. And they just don't get it.
Going back, Rod, to your point, you see, we forget that the English state is the oldest state apparatus in the world. Dates back to something like the 12th century when Henry decided to invade Ireland from Liverpool. You know, we forget, even today, what always amazes me when there's some complaint in the House of Parliament and it's investigated by some department undersecretary who decides what the process will be, what the punishment will be. Well, who are they? They're not accountable. It's that aspect of English statehood, I think, that we've lost sight of, because consistently the argument will always be the English state is never wrong, never ever wrong, and it can't seem to be wrong.
And I think what is you know, sort of in line with that, why I found it so dangerous when the government said, oh, we'll release all the documents, it actually took away a lot of rights of the families, because it was agreed that the documents would go to the panel. Therefore, whatever way they choose to bring the information out, it's under their control. The government relinquished its responsibility to a group of individuals. And equally, the panels say, we didn't appeal the Information Commissioner's ruling. The Home Office did, but what you've got is the panel is serviced by Home Office officials. So they're in their office, and the Home Office there appeal the ruling. So you're just sitting at different sides of the table. And what Daniel said is right. This is when you ask a direct question, because I always work on the constraints of time, whatever, in a meeting. I want to get this question, that question, and that question out. And when we met for the first time and we had all those questions, they wanted it to be just tea and sympathy and niceties about, oh, isn't this a lovely building? We're in the Cunard building. And they had us at a table. The bishop introduced himself to us before we went in the room. And we went in the room, which was a big, long table, and they were that side. And I just went to sit down, and the bishop went, oh, no, you sit opposite me, Sheila. And very pointedly, I sat opposite him. So they were that side, we were that side. And it was business as far as I was concerned. And he began by saying a prayer. And so, Steve, you'll like this. My convent education came to the fore. So when he finished the prayer, I blessed myself. And I went, you started it, you've shown that, there's the divide. You know, I mean, because I've just, and it's a tactic. I thought, right, okay now, because that was a disarming tactic. So I thought, well, I'll play you at your own game. Because once someone, and having the bishop as chair is no accident, because people think that, I mean, I've had to basically call him a liar. I mean, in the letter I wrote to him, I basically thought of God knows how many ways to say you're a liar. And I don't care. And if he pushes me, I will be very direct and go, you know you're lying. Because I can only respect people if they deserve respect and if they earn it. And I am not going to be seduced by his position as, you know, head of the Church of England, the Bishop of, you know, in Liverpool. It's awful. It really is. This whole idea that there's supposed to be a reverence. And so he wants to meet with our group, this sub-panel, in December, you know, before anything's resolved, and we'll have it in your shop. So whereas we invited them in initially, We are saying no, and we're saying you've got to recover a lot of groundwork to try and regain trust. If you really want to put it straight, meet with all three groups, meet with everyone at the same time, and tell us the same information. And it won't happen, but we'll keep pushing. We'll keep pushing, because that's all you can do, really. But I agree, what you're saying broadens it out, and I've always seen Hillsborough within the broader context of the society in which we live. And it's so difficult and frustrating that the state, I mean, it's tactics. I mean, my son says to me, oh, you read conspiracies into things where people are just, you know, inefficient. But smaller organisations might be. But at that very high level, people know what they're doing, and they try to wear you down, and they're not bothered if you've gone by the wayside, if you've died along the way, which a lot of families have done. And you know, in deaths in custody. I mean, the one that sort of really got me the other week, because I know his sister was Alder, Janet Alder's brother. You know about this up in...
Christopher,
yeah. In Hull. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, Christopher. Yeah. And I got very friendly with Janet, because we've spoken at the same things for quite some time. And I got to know her really well, and I attended Christopher's inquest. And his treatment at the hands of the police was appalling, and it's all there for video evidence. And then, if you don't know this, it was found out only the other week, they buried him, or they thought. But his body's still in a morgue in Hull. They had actually, it only came about because of, I think, an African woman or a West Indian woman had died. And her body was never claimed. They wanted her body taken home, and no one could afford it. And then a neighbour or a friend got the money together and said, I want to take her home. And can I see her body? And it was Christopher Alder's body.
What?
Yeah. What, I mean, you know, so it's not even a question. I mean, you know, the implicit racism in that, I mean, is unbelievable, isn't it? So you know, the older family thought they'd buried Christopher, and he's been lying in a morgue for all those years. How horrendous is that? And, you know, my heart went out to Janet, because she fought so hard. And I remember at the inquest, she was just so gutsy, and the coroner was going, you know, tell your client, you know, she had someone representing her. Be quiet, or should we? And she was just, I will not be quiet. This is, and I loved, because I'd sat through the Hillsborough inquest where everyone did sit quiet and played the game. So I loved to see her, you know, and I thought she got some satisfaction at least. But that is, you know, sort of, that's just one example of a death in custody. I mean, we are talking hundreds, aren't we? You know, well, more, really. So.
Well, I think that's the point I was getting at, is that, you know, the thing that was amazing, but I mean, I think it's right that, you know, I definitely don't fall into, like, you know, everything's a state conspiracy, I think that's ridiculous, but there, you know, it's not a question of conspiracy. You're in an organisation which communicates with each other, so it's not conspiracy, it's just
it's operational.
It's mutually beneficial.
So, and there is incompetence, and there is also fights between sections of that bureaucracy, and they don't agree, and sometimes they grass each other up, which is quite useful, you know, if they get really vicious. So there's all that stuff going on, but what I find amazing is, like, is the lying, but just the straightforward lying. I mean, Menendez is a great example, right? I mean, what the fucking hell were they making five lies on the first day?
Yes.
I mean, you know, it was obvious that the best thing to do was to say, like, nothing. And then when the information came out, well, you got the Commissioner of Metropolitan Police standing up and making five lies, which I'm not going through them now, on the first day. I find that amazing. I do think it's something to do with now, this whole idea of spinning stories. I mean, Mark Duggan thing's a good example where, you know, there was a bureaucratic disaster going on there. It wasn't purely like, oh, they got together and decided not to speak to Mark Duggan's family because they wanted to conspire to do that. No, they just didn't, because nobody wanted to deal with it. And there was a bureaucratic nightmare between the IPCC and the Met. But what's very interesting is they still span stories on those days, even bureaucratically there was a nightmare. So there's definitely, I think, a feeling now that you've got to engage in the media process, and it's been hard for quite a long time. Because in the old days, I think they used to just say nothing, didn't they?
Well, I think,
walk out and say no comment.
But even I think, you know, sort of, you saw it, I think it was, Hillsborough was quite groundbreaking like that, because just what you've said there is was true at Hillsborough. They started, that cover-up started on the day. I mean, that Sun headline, you know, Mackenzie's the headline. I mean, you know, it didn't, that come from somewhere. That he was told that, and he, you know, spun it into that.
I have a distant memory in the back of my head that Graham Kelly was interviewed on the TV in the evening, or about a couple of hours after it had happened, and made, you know, blame the Liverpool fans.
Yes.
And then he later came out and said, well, that's what the police told me, so that's what I believed. And somehow he managed to keep his job. I could never figure out how.
That's
he was
right.
chairman of the FA, wasn't
yes.
he?
Yes.
And I've never seen that replayed anywhere, but it was burnt into my
memory.
He did,
that's true. He was told by, and he was, I mean, I think the reason there was that Duckenfield, the officer in charge, he admitted he lied to him. And
but that was a matter of hours afterwards, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. Which is, I mean, and so this idea of getting your story straight, the cover-up was emerging on that day, and the subsequent day when Thatcher and Colin Moynihan, who was then sports minister, went to Sheffield. And I think the thing is that it's more sophisticated now, that I think there's more emphasis, I think, on spin.
Yeah.
But it was emerging then, and I think you saw it through that headline and through other stories. And, you know, going back to this freedom of information thing and cover-up, I mean, we believe that, sort of the Thatcher and in that cabinet meeting, the main emphasis was on how do we keep South Yorkshire Police out of this? I mean, it was payback time for them doing such a good job policing the miners. No, so...
What's funny about the spin thing is the main lesson for most spin doctors is that covering, you know, when you do the cover-up, it's being found out for the cover-up is often worse than the original sin. I mean, I think in this case, you know, as you say, there's enough kind of political... people, you know, real serious political interests and people just saying, you know, we're not going to do this. I mean, there's deliberate obfuscation. I don't think it is actually just bureaucratic screw-up 20 years later. They've had enough time. I mean, yeah, people's arses being covered. Friendships amongst close circles of elites. I mean, well, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just like, that's how elites work.
Yes, that's right.
I think it's a thing that the law applies to us, it doesn't apply to them. It's as straightforward as that, isn't it? We get the fucking law. They don't. They make the fucking law, don't they?
And, you know,
and the other thing, like the thing about why about the police and those people who you're saying are being sucked in, you know, thought of, you know, with tea and coffee, and then there'll be ears. That little kid in the school and say, oh, next week, kids, the teacher said, we're going to visit the police. So you find out what the police do. Anybody know anything about the police? And this little kid at the back puts his hand up to you. Yeah, I know about the police, yeah. Oh, well, what do you think of the police? It's all the police are bastards in this. Oh, well, we'll go next week and then you can come back and see if you change your mind. So they go off to the police station and they go down there and they're trying all the coppers' helmets and they see all the dogs and the horses and they have the fingerprints taken and have the photograph taken and they have a look in the cell and get a bit scared and then come out. Have tea and coffee, and come back to school, tea says. But what do you think of the police now? You say, all police are clever bastards, miss. That's exactly what they fucking do.
Nice. I think it's a lovely moment to sort of wrap that up. Thank you very much, sir. That's a beautiful moment to end. Thank you, too.